All right. Thank you, Chris. Well, like Chris was saying, it's the first week of everything happening. And the service for me was an exercise of focus because I kept thinking of, oh, I need to text Matt this, and I hope Megan's doing it. You know, and it's, when we came in this morning, all of these TVs that we had worked so hard to program and make sure that things didn't pop up on them, things were popping up on all of them, you know. So anyway, it's just one of those things where, but the Lord knows, and like Chris said, we are so thankful to be here. It's just amazing that we're actually in the building. It's still surreal. I know we've met for 4 weeks now prior to this, but it still feels like, are we really here, and does this actually belong to us? You know, we've been a mobile church for so long, so it's just strange, but awesome. There's no coffee or food this week. We'll work on that. That was another one of those things that just kind of got lost in the mix. I was going to say, if anyone has a desire to help with that, let me know after the service. But we're going to get a team going again. We had a little team over at the school that provided snacks, beverages, things like that each week. Coffee will be back, Lord willing, next week with Kingsgate and all that. But it's good to see you guys. You know, I was going to jump right back into where we left off, in Deuteronomy in November, but two things happened. One, I started thinking this might happen. We're gonna have a Sunday school, and there's gonna be a lot of people in here that weren't in the journey with us through Deuteronomy 19 so far. And then secondly, I forgot how to teach and where I was in Deuteronomy. And so as I started like reading through chapter 20 and preparing my mind or heart to teach chapter 20, I just thought, we got to do a review. I needed my own review, and I thought, if I need a review, we definitely need a review. So that's what we're going to do today. And this is actually kind of exciting because it allowed me to kind of dive back in. This week, I read the Pentateuch to like just quick, just like just a fast read through, but just getting my head back in the game, and then just rereading Deuteronomy again. It just reminded me how wonderful this book is. The gold that we've already dug out, that you just, it's so easy to forget all of the things that we've mined out of this book. And so this is going to be super fast. I'm going to take all of us through Deuteronomy 1 through 19 this morning, just to kind of, like I said, if you're joining us for the first time or if you're new to this Sunday school class, at least it gives you a little glimpse into what we've done, where we're at. If you want to hear more on any part of the book, the sermons are out there on the Sojourners podcast thing. But at least it gets us there, and I think it'll get us back to the place where we left off in November. But we started this journey in Deuteronomy back in September of 2023. I didn't know that either until I started kind of looking back through the notes. So it's been a while. We've had, you know, a couple of breaks here and there. But we started out with a background on the book itself. And then after that, we took a two-week flyover of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, because you have to know what has happened in those books for Deuteronomy to make sense. I mean, in Deuteronomy, Moses is giving three sermons on the plains of Moab right before Israel goes in to take the promised land. And he is recounting everything from the time where God called Abraham and made these promises to Abraham that are actually being fulfilled right in front of their eyes as they're standing there, all the way through the, you know, Isaac and Jacob, everything that happened in the Exodus, the first generation and what happened with them, all that the Lord spoke from Mount Sinai to the whole of Israel, and then what he revealed to Moses to give to Israel. On top of that, Leviticus and all the stuff given to the priests the Levites on the sacrifices and all that sort of stuff. And then in Numbers, really the journey, rejecting the Lord, not going into the land, and then the journey of the second generation, well, the first generation dying off and the second generation making it to this place where we are sitting right now on the plains of Moab across the Jordan River with Jericho over there and the Lord about to commission Joshua and then take Israel into the promised land. And so, like I said, I thought it would be good this morning maybe to do just a big picture, brief overview of the whole thing. And so, really, I think starting at Genesis 15, this is a verse to remember. And, you know, we talked about this when we were going through Genesis. But when the Lord made the covenant with Abraham, made the Abrahamic covenant, and actually this is relevant to what Shane just talked about. God showed up in darkness and fire here. The presence of God was there, and it was darkness around. And in this great darkness, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, and he swore to Abraham all the things that are happening right now with the nation of Israel. But in Genesis 15, 12 through 21, it says, "Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abram, so this is the presence of the Lord entering into this covenant with Abraham, ratifying this covenant. He says, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve. Now we know that that is Egypt that he's brought them out of. And he says, and afterwards they will come out with many possessions, which happened. And as for you, he says, you shall go to your fathers in peace. So he will die and you'll be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation, they will return here. Now he is currently at this time in the land of Canaan as a sojourner. He says, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. So it's not time for the Lord to judge those nations. He'll do it in his perfect timing. And it says, it came about when the sun had set and it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed through these pieces. That is the presence of Yahweh himself ratifying this unilateral covenant with Abraham. Basically, he taking it upon himself, God taking it upon himself to make sure all these things are fulfilled. And it says, on that day, the Lord, Yahweh, made a covenant with Abram saying, to your descendants I have given this land. From the river of Egypt, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite and the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. And again, we see those names over and over. These are different nations within the territory of Canaan. And so all that being said, the Lord swore this to Abram way before Moses, hundreds of years before Moses or the nation of Israel had been developed within the land of Egypt and brought out by God. And the Lord gave this land to the people of Israel. And it's an eternal, everlasting, unilateral covenant that God made with himself to do these things. And again, we followed this covenant through Genesis. We talked about the as the Lord continues to talk about geographical land that they would inherit, that the nation of Israel would be developed, and he would make them a nation and give them a land and establish it forever for them. And he calls this his land, all of that sort of stuff. And so in Genesis, you see this covenant. You see the covenant go through Isaac and through Jacob. And then and Joseph. And then Joseph dies and tells them to carry his bones. And then we open up to Exodus. And basically, Exodus is the Lord remembering this covenant. And the Lord calling Moses and delivering his people out of Egypt. So 400 years have passed. A lot of Israelites or a lot of descendants from Abram have been born by that time. But they're enslaved in the land of Egypt, if you read that in Exodus. And so the Lord basically brings them out through great signs and wonders, these plagues on Egypt, delivers his people from Egypt, gives them the treasures of Egypt as they leave, and Moses leads them out through the Red Sea as it parts, and then brings them into the wilderness at a place called Horeb, at a mount called Sinai. And at Mount Sinai, the Lord reveals himself to Israel. He makes a covenant with this nation, Israel. And this covenant was different than the Abrahamic covenant. This is a bilateral covenant. So each side has a part, if you want to say it that way. It's a conditional covenant. There are conditions for Israel. If you listen to the Lord, submit to his word, follow and obey him, then they will watch and see the blessings of Yahweh God as he blesses them in ways that are significant and would be a testimony to all the nations of God's blessing towards them because of their obedience to him. But if they disobey Yahweh God, if they forsake him to seek other gods or turn their back on him to be like the nations that are around them, then they will inherit the curse that will come from Yahweh God, which will still prove his sovereignty and power and faithfulness to his word, even though Israel is unfaithful to him. And so the blessings and the curses are laid out, and we call this the Mosaic Covenant, or this is the covenant that the Lord made with the nation of Israel. And he declared Israel to be his own possession, to be his kingdom of priests to the nations around them, and to be his holy nation, his nation that he set apart, distinct and different than any nation that would ever exist. And they are still his holy nation. They are still his people. He has still given them the land that he swore to give to Abram. And he will bring them back. They will repent. They will return. And all of this is even laid out in Deuteronomy and then throughout the Old Testament. But in Exodus 20 through 24, Yahweh shows up on Mount Sinai and reveals himself and his covenant to the people of Israel. The reason I'm telling you this is because Deuteronomy is Moses recalling many of the things that the Lord said from Mount Sinai to his people. And so in Exodus 20 through 24, you see him give the Ten Commandments. You see him reveal to Moses judgments that the Israelites needed to know. And then the covenant is ratified with the nation of Israel right there at Mount Sinai in Exodus 24. Exodus 25 through 40, Yahweh reveals to his people the design of the tabernacle, where they are to worship him, the place where his name will dwell, the place where his glory will be, where his presence will be in the midst of Israel. And then he tells them how to worship him, who he is, his holiness, how he's to be approached, how to atone for sin. And he gives them all of the understanding of basically how to construct the tabernacle, and it is constructed, and the glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle at the very end of Exodus, in Exodus 40. So now the glory of God is in the presence of Israel, in the Holy of Holies, in the tabernacle, as they move through the wilderness over the next 40 years. Leviticus is basically takes about it's about a month of time, and the book of Leviticus explains and trains the priests on how to worship Yahweh God and how to instruct the people on how to worship Yahweh. It defines and describes the sacrifices. It gives instructions on how to perform the sacrifices for the priests. It reminds the Israelites of the holiness of God. And there's many regulations of cleanliness. There's uncleanness and cleanness throughout the book of Leviticus. And there's ceremonial laws to remind the Israelites what they are to be before they approach the Lord, and the distinction between them and all the nations around them. And so the Lord lays out a lot of things about food and clothing, hygiene, leprosy, things like that, because Israel was to be his holy nation. They were to be different than all the other nations. So even the way they dress and the way they eat and the way they approach God and the way they live their life, it matters. And it reminds us of what we learn in 1 Corinthians, that we whether we eat or drink or whatever we do, we want to do all things to the glory of the Lord. And Leviticus shows a lot of those things, of how the Israelites were to submit to him, even in what they eat and how they dress and what they do, to be distinct and different. Holiness is the emphasis of Leviticus. It's a revelation of the holiness of God and who he is, and how the Israelites themselves were to listen to him to pursue a life of holiness as God's holy people. There's the clearest explanation of the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16 and 17, which again comes up in Deuteronomy. And also in Leviticus 18, there's a very clear and definitive statement of Israel's distinctiveness. They are not to be like any nation. They are not to imitate anything of the nations that they are destroying in the land of Canaan, nor the surviving nations that will exist around them after they inherit that land. They are to be a light to the world. They are to be different and distinct from all other nations, because they are Yahweh, holy people. He has set them apart, and he calls them to listen to his words, to keep his commandments, and to do and to obey all that he commands them to do. And two big things that stand out in Leviticus that again are reiterated in Deuteronomy is immorality and idolatry. Not only are abominations from the word of the Lord, but also if they engage in idolatry, if they serve and worship any other god, or engage in the immorality of the nations around them or the nations that they're dispossessing, then the wrath of God will abide upon them, and he will do to them exactly what he did to the nations that are their dispossession. So it comes with a warning as well. In Leviticus 23, we see the appointed times of Yahweh, which we just got out of that in our class, and we'll review that quickly, but we were in Leviticus 23 for a while. And then Leviticus 25, we have the whole sabbatical system, how the Lord takes care of the orphan and those who are poor and dependent upon the people around them providing, and for the Lord providing, and how he provides rest for his people. Leviticus 26 is the blessings and the curse of the Mosaic Covenant, which again are reiterated in Deuteronomy, and it ends with a declaration from Yahweh that he will never break his covenant with Abraham. He will never reject Israel, and he will not destroy them. He will redeem his nation, Israel, and that is refers back to the Abrahamic covenant. He must, and it has nothing to do with their obedience or disobedience, but with his covenant oath that he made to Abram. In Numbers, basically, Numbers is a book of the 40 years in the desert after their disobedience. It begins with them leaving Sinai, and then they get to Kadesh Barnea, and that's where the first generation does not listen to the word of the Lord. They do not go in and take the land. Instead, they decide, you know, we're going to return back to Egypt. And the Lord basically says that all of them will fall in the desert. All of the first generation dies. And the Lord promises, I will bring your children into this land and give it to them. And that is where we are in Deuteronomy. The second generation of Israelites, the first generation has died off. When they crossed the river Zered, that was the end of the first generation. And now we have the second generation of Israelites, who also in Numbers, actually, if you really read Numbers, from Numbers, you know, pretty much 15 to 36, the majority of Numbers is really dealing with the second generation of Israelites. And Moses is already, during the journey and on the plains of Moab, taught them many of the statutes of the Lord. They've already engaged in battles and taken all of the land east of the Jordan River from Sihon, king of Heshbon and Og. It's Og and Sihon, both Amorite kings on the east side of the Jordan River. And now they are on the plains of Moab. They just went through all the stuff with Balaam coming and trying to, you know, curse them, but instead prophesies about their prosperity and then tells the Midianite kings how to get the Lord to pour out his wrath on his own people. And so they've already gone and they have fought against Midian and they have destroyed all those that the Lord has told them to do. And now they are sitting on the plains of Moab. They're about to go into the promised land. And that's what Deuteronomy is about. Deuteronomy is three sermons of Moses, basically reminding the Israelites of everything we just talked about, hitting all, not only the highlights, but reminding them of the word that the Lord has given them on Mount Sinai and calling them to covenant faithfulness to him and reminding them that their prosperity and their ability to stay in the land and the blessings that the Lord has promised is dependent upon them listening to every word he has spoken, submitting to him, loving him with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength, and obeying his commands. And so, all that being said, that's where we are. And so, the purpose of Deuteronomy, like I said, it's a series of expositions or a series of sermons by Moses, three sermons, reviewing the history of the nation of Israel, everything that has happened from Exodus to Numbers, and challenging the new generation of Israelites who will soon enter the promised land to live faithfully to the covenant that Yahweh their God has made with them. And so, all that being said, Deuteronomy is really, it's a review. We call it review and renew the covenant. It's not a new covenant. It's the same covenant that God made, or that God proclaimed from Mount Sinai, but now it is being renewed with the next generation before they go in. We also call it the second generation exhortation. So these are two ways that we've kind of been saying it in here to remind ourselves of what it is. It's to remind Israel of their history, to prepare them for the future, both the immediate future when they inherit the land and they're in the land, living in the land. And then in Deuteronomy 29 and 30, you're going to see he's also preparing the nation of Israel for their future repentance and the return of Jesus Christ, the King, when they actually return to the land permanently under the reign and rule of Jesus Christ, when God circumcises their hearts and they enter into the new covenant, which is awesome. So there's a glimpse of the new covenant there at the very end of Deuteronomy. To give you a little bit of background behind Deuteronomy is the last book of the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch is the first five books of the Bible. The Jewish people called these books the Torah. The word Deuteronomy comes from a Greek translation of the Septuagint, which means second law. But it's not a second law, it's a renewal of the law. It's for the second generation. And so that's why we call it, like I said, the second generation exhortation, or reviewing and renewing the law. The author of Deuteronomy is Moses. It's attributed to Moses throughout the writings and even in the New Testament by Jesus. And so we are sure that Moses wrote these first five books, except for probably at the very end of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, 32 to 40, 34. I think somebody trying to connect to the AirPlay. That's something else we'll have to figure out. Oh, yeah, it might be. We'll see what happens. Oh yeah, Shreyas. That's so funny. We'll have to tell him. Moses died in 1405 BC, and Deuteronomy had to be written sometime prior to Moses' death, because he dies at the very end of Deuteronomy. All these expositions of Deuteronomy happen in one place over about a month period of time. They're on the plains of Moab, and we know this because of Deuteronomy 1 talks about when They got there. Deuteronomy 34:8 talks about Moses dying, and it took 30 days. Weeping and mourning after he died. And then Joshua 5:10, it says that on the 14th day of the first month, they left the desert plains to go to Jericho. So you can ascertain there that this is about a month time. All right, let's see what happens here. Oh, it says I'm connected, but you can't see it. Try it again. My fear is that something's going to pop up on that TV while we're doing this. Maybe not. All right. Well,
if you force it to change the source, like if you use the remote to change the source on the TV, would that make it better?
Maybe, I don't know.
Just a thought.
Yeah, maybe. Like I said, I just don't want to change the source.
I'm not used to this stuff.
Yeah. Well, week number one, so if we don't have a slideshow, we'll figure it out. It's waiting for, mine's waiting for a code, but I don't see a code popping up. So if a code pops up, let me know. Let's just keep moving.
Sure, it's probably easier code.
That's funny. He runs over here, 4307. All right. Well, getting back to where we left off, the purpose of Deuteronomy, like I said, is these are expositions of Moses to review and renew the covenant. In Deuteronomy 31, 9 through 13, it actually says that they are to renew this covenant continually in their existence in the land. So every 7 years, they are to renew this covenant with each subsequent generation so that each generation of Israelites learns the word of the Lord, learns to fear and to submit to the Lord, and understands who Yahweh God is. In Deuteronomy 31, 9 through 13, it says, Moses wrote this law. Speaking of the book of Deuteronomy, he gave it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who carried the Ark of the Covenant, and all the elders of Israel. And then Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the time of the remissions of debts, which is the sabbatical, the 7 year period, at the Feast of Booths, when all the Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God at the place which he will choose, which is in the temple in Jerusalem, or at the tabernacle at Shiloh before the temple, he says, you shall read this law in front of all Israel in their hearing. Assemble the people, the men and the women and the children and the alien who is in your town, and here's the purpose, so that they may hear and learn and fear the Lord your God and be careful to observe all the words of this law. Their children who have not known will hear and learn to fear the Lord your God as long as you live in the land which you are about to cross the Jordan to possess. So what Moses is doing with Israel on the plains of Moab, Joshua will do right after this in Joshua 8 at Mount Ebal and Gerizim and Shechem, and he will renew the covenant after they go over and take the land. And then Israel was supposed to do this regularly throughout their history at the Feast of Booths every 7 years to remind each generation, all the children that are being born in each generation, of who God is, what he has said to them, what he has called them to be, and how to love him with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength. That is the purpose of this book. But what we saw, and we talked about this when we did the appointed feasts and the festivals and all that, Israel failed to do this. And this failed to be renewed over and over and over again. And you see how quickly, right at the beginning of the book of Judges, the next generation falls away from the Lord and begins to bring in idolatry and try to imitate the people of the land that they're supposed to destroy. And so you see immediately how Israel fails to do what the Lord called them to do. And then we see the end result of Israel inheriting all that the Lord swore in the curses of the Mosaic Covenant. Man, I wish you could see that. I have an outline here, and this would be so good to see. Let me try one more time. And maybe you're right with the input thing. Yeah. Well, let's just see what happens. Oh, you're right. It got off HDMI. Woohoo! All right. 7887. Let's try this one. The things we learn. All right. So here's an outline of Deuteronomy to kind of give you a big picture of the book. All right. So again, this is just getting everybody on page. So here's your three expositions of Moses. The first exposition is basically, it's four chapters. It's what God has done. It's a real brief history of Israel from Horeb, which is where Mount Sinai is, to Kadesh Barnea. That is where the 12 spies reject the word of the Lord. They rebel against him, and the curse comes upon the first generation. Letter B, there under the basic chapters 2 and 3, are them getting from Kadesh Barnea, where they reject the Lord, to the plains of Moab, where they are right now. So that's a 40-year period just encapsulated in two chapters real quick. It really mainly has to do with what happened with the second generation after they crossed the Brook Zered and the 38 years of wandering and the end of the first generation. And chapter 2 talks about the defeat of Sihon, the Amorite king of Heshbon. Chapter 3 talks about the defeat of Og, the Amorite king of Bashan, and then dividing the land amongst the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half a tribe of Manasseh on the east side of the Jordan River. And so those tribes have their land, and now they're going to cross over with Israel to take the rest of the land, but they'll come back over here. And chapter 4, oh, it says guidance towards obedience here, but that is a huge chapter where the Lord really just gives the essence and the heart of the law, of the Mosaic Covenant, and he reminds them that their success both in taking the land and even remaining in the land is dependent on their submission to him. So it's not about their strength, their might, their wisdom, their righteousness. It's about them listening to and submitting to the Lord, trusting him. If they trust him, he will take care of them. He will defeat their enemies. He will allow them to remain in the land. He will send them blessings, an abundance of blessings, of fruitfulness, of vegetation, and enemies not destroying them. All these things, if they will just trust him and listen to him. But if they reject him and follow other idols, then their neglect of him will have not only an effect on them, a detrimental effect on their living in the land. Enemies will attack, all that sort of stuff, but even generational effects. And so he reminds them to guard themselves from idols, to not forget the covenant. And then he also, in the very end of chapter 4, reminds them in the latter days, they will fall away and he will restore them. So even right there at the very beginning of the first exposition, there's a small snippet that reminds Israel that even if they are unfaithful to Yahweh God, he will be faithful to do everything that he swore to Abraham. And so their lack of faithfulness will bring about the curses of the Mosaic Covenant. But his faithfulness to Abraham will bring about the promises that he has made to Abraham. And it's a reminder of that, the God's choice of Israel, that they are a unique nation. And he actually ends in chapter 4, 39 and 40. He says, "Know therefore today and take it to your heart that the Lord, he is God, in heaven above and on earth below. There is no other. So you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I am giving you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, that you may live long on the land which the Lord your God is giving you for all time." So it's theirs permanently. It's his permanently. He's given it to Israel permanently. But whether or not they remain temporarily is dependent on their submission and obedience to him. Does that make sense? So listen to what he says. Trust him with all of your heart. Love him with all of your heart. And obey everything that he says. He will take care of you if you trust in him. So that's the first exposition. Second exposition is where we're at. So this is going to catch you up to where we're at. This is basically what God expects. This is the Mosaic Covenant. In chapters 5 through 26, he goes over the first, from 5 through 11, this is the heart and the essence of the law. This is God's relationship with Israel. In chapters 5 through 11, he reveals the Ten Commandments again, and then over and over and over and over calls Israel to trust him, to cling to him, to love him, to submit to him, to obey him, to keep his commands, to follow him. That has been some of the greatest part of Deuteronomy, and we'll review that in a second. Exposition of the statutes from 12 to 16. 17 is basically once you get into the land, here's the judgments of the Lord, and this is how you are to function and to live as his holy nation. And then chapter 16 through 26, again, he gives basically judgments of righteousness. The officials are to be righteous. Civil law is to be in righteousness. The family is to operate in righteousness. It's all a focus on righteousness. The third exposition is what God will do. It's the blessings and the curses. In chapters 27, you have the curses that will you'll see in Joshua. They'll be represented on Mount Ebal, the blessings of Gerizim, and then you have the second generation entering into the covenant in chapter 29, and a glimpse of the new covenant in chapter 30, which again, that's going to be wonderful to get to, and it's just a testimony of Christ. And then in the very end, the historical appendix, this is what we say There's the exhortation of Moses in 31, and then probably 32 through 34 is written by Joshua. It's a song of Moses and the blessings of Moses, and then the death of Moses. And so that's the book of Deuteronomy, kind of the outline of it. When we talk about the purpose of the law or the purpose of Deuteronomy, this is something we've emphasized over and over and over. We are not Israel. We are the church. This is a covenant made with the nation of Israel. And in some sense, you have to always remind yourself of that. This is not a covenant made with you and with me. We are not to enter into this covenant as the church. And Israel was not the church, and the church is not Israel, and church has not replaced Israel. This is a covenant the Lord made with the nation of Israel. And this is a conditional covenant with the nation of Israel. That being said, we learn a lot about the character and nature of God through this covenant. We learn a lot about what God desires and expects from those who trust Him and entrust themselves to Him. We can glean a ton of things from the law and from Deuteronomy. And at the same time, recognize that, again, we are not Israel and we are not in this covenant with God. This is something that is for the nation of Israel, and it's something that has been fulfilled by Christ. It is something that Christ, that even the things in the Old Covenant or in the Mosaic Covenant pointed to Christ, whether it's the sacrifices, whether it's the whole temple and the role of the high priest, even the sacrifice itself. Many of those things, Hebrews explains very clearly to us, point directly to what Jesus Christ will do on the cross. And Deuteronomy, even, like in chapter 30, talks about this new covenant promise that we have through Christ, and we are the church. We are the body of Christ. The church began in Acts 2, and it will end when the Lord raptures the church, and then there will be a future for Israel as the nation repents. But the thing that you need to, I think the thing that you have to keep clear as we look at Deuteronomy is not taking these things and thinking the Lord expects this of me because of this covenant He made with Israel. And at the same time, you can glean so much out of the law that the Lord desires and expects for His people. Many of these things are reiterated very clearly in the New Testament, and other things just reveal to us what righteousness and faithfulness and submission and obedience and love look like, because the Lord has laid that out very clearly with His nation, and we can pull that into our lives. And so that's what we've been trying to do. Recognize what the Lord's doing for Israel, but man, gleaning as much out of this as we can to apply in our lives as the church of Jesus Christ under the new covenant, washed clean by the blood of Jesus Christ. And so that's some of the things I want to point out today to get you there. Because a lot of times you look at the Old Testament, you're like, well, that's not for us. But it's totally for us. In fact, you can't understand the New Testament clearly without a good understanding of the Old Testament, because that is where you get, I mean, you talk about the millennial kingdom of Jesus Christ. The majority of that is in the Old Testament. You talk about what Christ will do when He returns and what this earth will look like and what He'll do for His people. That's in the Old Testament. What God will do for the nation of Israel and for this land, the Abrahamic and Davidic and New Covenant promises, all in the Old Testament. So again, the Old Testament is very profitable, very good for us to know, but understanding who we are and how to apply this in our life. I think one of the first things is to look at what Jesus Christ says about the law itself. When the Pharisees came to Him and said, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment of the law?" And He said to them, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Look at this. "On these two commandments depend the whole law and prophets." All right, so that was the purpose. The Lord revealed who He was, and He called Israel to love Him with all their heart, with all their soul, with all their might, and then to love one another the way that He loves Him, which is exactly what Christ calls us as the church to do in the New Testament. So the heart and the essence of both is exactly the same. Does that make sense? We're not Israel. This law is not for you. But the things that the Lord tells Israel, many of these are directly applicable to us and can teach us a lot about what love is, what God desires, how we should love one another, and who He is. And so this is huge. And God Himself commentating on His own law. This is like Jesus showing up and going, "You want me to sum up Deuteronomy in two sentences? Here it is." And nothing has changed in His expectation. So this is the essence and the heart. This is the law. In John 14, 15, Jesus says, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." And in John 1 John 5, 3, again, this is to the church. He says, "For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not burdensome." Nothing has changed when it comes to what love is. Our love towards God is displayed. Our love with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength is displayed by our trusting Him, listening to Him, submitting to everything He says, and obeying Him. That is love. And we want to love Him in that way. And you can see over and over in the law what the love of God, what God's love towards us and our love towards Him looks like. And in fact, we knew these things from the New Testament, but studying Deuteronomy has helped us understand these things, at least me, I can speak for myself. I have understood this in such a more clear way as we read Deuteronomy and we see what God has done for them, what His love is displayed on them, and what He expects from them as love displayed to Him. And again, John 14 and 15, He says the same thing. Jesus says, "He who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father. I will love him. I will disclose myself to him. If anyone loves me, he will keep my word. And my Father will love him, and we will come and make our abode with him." That is a new covenant promise right there. So again, this is oriented towards us. It says, "He who does not love me does not keep my words, and the word you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love." So, submitting to the Lord, keeping his commandments, following him. This is always how love is displayed. And that's what Deuteronomy is all about. God himself has drawn Israel out of Egypt. He's formed them into his own nation. He has revealed himself to them in his glory on Mount Sinai, spoken audibly to them, and given them 10 commandments that explain very clearly how to love him and how to love others, and then expounds on that with Moses up on the mountain with them to bring down to Israel to teach them how to worship him, how to conduct their government for the nation of Israel, and how to treat one another. The moral law, or the law of love, all those things. He is teaching Israel how to love the Lord their God with all their heart, all their mind, and all their strength. And that is the purpose of the law. And so, that being said, Deuteronomy is very profitable and very good for us to understand and know. And so, even as the church in the new covenant. And so, he tells them the essence of the law is to love the Lord your God. That is the vertical law of love. The first four commandments given to them teach them how to love God with all their heart. And then, love your neighbor, the horizontal law of love, is commandments 5 through 10. So, even just the 10 commandments can sum it up very quickly. But the Lord expounds on that to teach them more and more and more throughout Deuteronomy. So, all that being said, we are in the second exposition, and the second exposition begins in chapter 5 with the Ten Commandments. In chapter 5 through 11, if you should go read it on your own, like tonight or this week, you'll see over and over and over the Lord say things like this, like, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinance that you have heard. Learn them and observe them carefully. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, all those who are alive here today." He reiterates the covenant, the Ten Commandments. He tells them, "These are the words that the Lord spoke to you from the fire and from the darkness." He says, "You will do well to keep them in your heart and in your soul and to do them." And that is the emphasis over and over and over. In Deuteronomy 6, he tells them to teach and to do all that he commands. He tells them to teach this to their children so their children know who Yahweh God is, to talk about him when they're lying down, rising up, going in, coming out, writing on the doorpost of your house. Your children should see it in your life and in your words and everything that you do. So teach your children. So it starts with the family. They're to renew this covenant as a nation every 7 years. But you as father and mother of the family are to constantly be pointing to the word of the Lord. Constantly be living in submission to him. So that you are a testimony of faithfulness to your children. And you're teaching them who he is. And again, we have very similar commands as Christian parents in the New Testament. In the rest of chapter 6, you see what the tests of love and faithfulness will look like. He tells them to learn from their parents' mistakes. Don't forget what the first generation did. And don't do that, but do the opposite. And he tells them to teach their children to fear Yahweh God. So that's how it starts. And again, you can see many application points in all of that for us. In chapter 7, he starts talking to them about the peril of idolatry and what will happen if you turn away from him. They are always going to be his people, but if they forsake him, turn their backs on him, or go after other idols, then they will bring about the judgment of Yahweh God on themselves. He says, if they follow other idols, he says, they will turn your sons from following me, they will serve other gods, the anger of Yahweh will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. So with the commandment of how to love him also comes the warning of what will happen if you forsake the Lord Yahweh. He says, but thus you shall do to them. You shall tear down their altars, shatter their sacred pillars, cut down their ashram in pieces, and burn their graven images with fire. So when you go into the land, do not compromise and destroy all idolatry. And this is said over and over and over in Deuteronomy. You have to destroy it all. You have to rid the land of idolatry or you will forsake me. And again, just like us, it's easy for the people of Israel, just like it is for us, to think, well, it's not that big of a sin. It's okay. I got rid of 99.5% of it. But if you keep a little bit there, that thing will take root and it will destroy you. And so, just like them, we must destroy all idolatry in our life. He goes on to talk about why. Because they're the people of Yahweh. He says, you are a holy people to Yahweh your God. Yahweh your God has chosen you to be a people for his own treasure possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. So again, it's understanding who you are. Understanding what you are, what Yahweh has done for you, and your purpose in this land. You are to be his holy nation. You are to be his kingdom of priests. And you cannot do that if you're serving other gods or if you're not submitting in faithfulness to all that he's called you to be. And so, again, after reminding them of the peril of idolatry, he calls them, he reminds them of who they are as his people. And then he says this, and you'll see this over and over in Deuteronomy. He says, basically, listen, keep, and do. We talked about this. It says, then it will be because you listen to these judgments and you keep and do them that Yahweh your God will keep his covenant of loving kindness, which he swore to your fathers. You will see this over and over and over. It says he will love you. He will bless you. He will multiply you. He will bless the fruit of your womb. He will bless the fruit of the ground. He will bless the new wine, the oil, the increase of the herd, the young of your flock, and the land. Again, the prosperity of the land depends on their faithfulness and submission to Yahweh God, not their ingenuity and then figuring out how to farm the land and how to cultivate more cattle and all of that. It has to do with submission to God, obedience to him. If you trust him and you obey him, he will take care of you. But if you turn your back on him, then your life will be hard and eventually you will be destroyed and you will be kicked out of this land. And so he reminds them, listen, keep, and do. These are said over and over. 24 times in Deuteronomy, he says, keep what I have commanded you. Listen to these things and do them. After that, he reminds them of their time in the desert. And he reminds them that their submission to him, their obedience to him, the humility that they need to be his people, that was all forged by trials in the desert. He says, you shall remember the way which Yahweh your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years. Why? So that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandment or not. Those 40 years in the desert were a judgment to the first generation, but they were also a test of the faithfulness of the second generation. And they brought them to the place of humility and brokenness that they were able to go in and take the land. Does that make sense? And again, it's the same thing in our life. We see this in the New Testament. We see over and over that trials are purposed for us to be broken, to be humble, to be submissive and dependent upon the Lord. The Lord uses these to create holiness in us and craft us more and more into the image of Christ. So he uses trials in our life if we trust him to form us more into his image, to make us more like Christ, and to cause blessing in our life, both here and eternally. And it was very similar to what he did for his people in the desert. And so he's telling them, remember what you went through, because the trial in the desert prepared them to enter the land. And then he warns them after that, in the end of chapter 8, when you get into the land and you do prosper and there are blessings, don't turn your back on me. Because again, that is our natural tendency and that's what we do even in this life. Think about it. Like when you're pressed hardest, when you don't know if you're going to make ends meet at the end of the month, when your children are in the hospital, when things around you are going very poorly, culturally or even personally, that's usually when the child of God is clinging to the Lord, on their knees, praying to him, striving for him, and all these other things that seem to matter don't matter at all. All that matters is him, right? But then when things go well and we have an abundance of money, we're blessed in life, whatever, and then, you know, we have a culture that seems like more Christian-esque or something like that, that is when we forget him. That is when we forsake him. That's when we get comfortable in this life. And so he warns his people of that as well. You have been through the fire of the wilderness. You are clinging to me and prepared to go into the land. Once you get into the land and you receive my blessings that come from me because of your faithfulness, don't turn your back on me and forsake me. He warns them because that is what will happen. He says, beware lest you forget Yahweh. We talked about the peril of forgetfulness, the peril of not practicing obedience to the Lord, the peril of having plenty, and the peril of pride. These are still the things that cause us to forget and forsake the Lord, even as his children. And so he reminds them of that. And then he reminds them to remember how they got here. Remember who sustains them. Remember who made them. And remember who strengthens them. The way that they will not forsake him is by constantly reminding themselves of him and all that he has done, both before they got there and in the land. And that is by remembering his word and what he has done for them. And so that gets us through chapter 8. Chapter 9 reminds them to beware of self-righteousness. In chapter 9, he reminds them to beware of self-righteousness. It's a funny chapter because he very clearly tells them, it is not because of your righteousness that you've been here. Three times he says, it is not your righteousness that brought you here. It is not your uprightness of heart. It is not your righteousness that brought you to this good land. And he even says in verse 6 and 7, you are a stubborn people. Remember and do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day that you left the land of Egypt until you arrived at this place in Moab, he says, you have been rebellious against the Lord. So don't ever think there's something good, inherently good in me, and that's why God chose me. That's why God made us a nation. That's why God brought us in this land. He says, from the day I spoke to you to today, you've always rebelled against me. It's his faithfulness and his righteousness and his covenant loving kindness that has brought them to this land. And that's not just to crush them with words. It's just to remind them of who he is and who they are. And we need the same thing as Christians, right? It is not your goodness and your righteousness that you're sitting in this room. If anything, you ought to know that you're the worst of all sinners, that we don't deserve to be here. It's only his grace and his mercy and his kindness that's allowed us to be in this place. And we deserve the wrath of God that Christ paid on the cross. That's what we deserve. And so it's not our righteousness. In the same way, he reminded them of that. He says, remember your power is in in Yahweh, your plans. Remember the plans that he has for you. Remember your past rebellion and remember the promise that he has made. That is what will remind them to not be self-righteous. And then at the very end in chapter 10 and 11, it is this call to love him with all their heart. Over and over and over in 10 and 11, Moses ends this first half of the second sermon by reminding them, the Lord desires wholehearted obedience, wholehearted submission, wholehearted devotion. This is what the Lord wants. This is the heart of the law. This is the essence of Deuteronomy. And this is exactly what the Lord wants for us. He wants wholehearted obedience, submission, and devotion because that shows wholehearted love of him. And that is the heart of the law. And he reminds them over and over and over. In chapter 10, 14, he says, behold, to the Lord your God belongs the heaven, the highest heavens and the earth and all that's in it. This is all his. And he says, yet on your fathers did the Lord set his affection to love them, and he chose their descendants after them, even you, above all peoples, as it is to this day. So circumcise your heart and stiffen your neck no longer. He says, stop fighting me. Stop bucking up against me. Stop standing toe-to-toe with God. Trust me. Listen to me. I love you. And I've proven it by bringing you here, fulfilling these promises I've made to your fathers. And you are standing on the plains of Moab because of my love and my faithfulness. Now love me with all of your heart. And then in chapter 11, he reminds them, if they do this, that he will bless them. And over and over and over in chapter 11, he tells them, love me, obey every commandment, love and serve me, keep and teach all of my word. And then at the very end, he reminds them very briefly of the blessings and the curses that are attached with this covenant. But look at that. Chapter 5 all the way to 11. Six chapters there. Well, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Seven chapters there. It's all about his love for them and their call to love him by being obedient, submissive, keeping his word, listening to his word, teaching their children his word, and doing his word. Does that make sense? That is very similar to everything the Lord has called us to in the New Testament, right? We're not Israel. We're not in this covenant. But you can get a lot out of what the heart of God is for his people, what God desires for his people, and what we should desire to be towards him from Deuteronomy 5 through 11. It's huge. And that is the heart of the law. And again, it goes back to what Christ said in John and in Matthew. You can sum up the whole thing with love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul and strength. From there until where we are now, basically from chapter 12 to chapter 19. So that then that's where we left off, and that's where we'll pick up next week. He begins to get into specific statutes. After talking about the essence and the heart, the big picture for the first seven chapters, then he begins to talk to them. Once you get into this land, once you're in the land, here's exactly what to do in order to fulfill the essence of the law, to love him with all their heart. The first thing he tells them to do when they get into the land is they must destroy all idolatry, all remnants of false worship, and worship only in the place and in the way that Yahweh prescribes. So he tells them in chapters 12 and 13, when you come into the land, you must destroy everything, anything that pays any worship or devotion to any other god, and you must worship me only in the place where my name dwells, which at that time currently is in the tabernacle, which will be located in Shiloh. That is where they are to go and to worship. Right now, the tabernacle is with them wherever they travel. But once they go into the land, they'll disperse, but they are to come to these to the tabernacle to worship him corporately three times a year, which we'll talk about in a second. But they are only to worship him in the place and in the way that he calls them to worship. And then he says in chapter 13, actually, he says, destroy anyone or anything that would purpose to drive you away from Yahweh. If any person, if there's a false teacher in the land, destroy them. If it's someone in your family, destroy them. If a whole town rises up and says there's another God or there's another way, destroy them. He says this stuff will spread like gangrene and it will destroy you. Not only that, if you don't destroy them, God will destroy you, because He will not tolerate any idolatry, and idolatry will be detrimental to them remaining in the land and to their subsequent generations. And then he reminds them once again, after the warning of idolatry, of who they are. You are the sons of Yahweh. You are his holy people. You are his chosen, treasured possession. So that gets us through chapter 14. At the very end of chapter 14, he tells them that they have to have wholehearted devotion and love in everything they do, in how they dress, in how they eat, in what they eat, in where they eat, how they, all this can be done in love and obedience and submission to Yahweh God. It reminds them that everything matters, that everything we do, and again, in the New Testament, in word or deed, how we eat, whatever we do, we want to do all things to the glory of the Lord. He calls them to the same standards. He gives them standards on what they can and cannot eat, standards of cleanliness and things like that. In chapter 15, he gets into this whole sabbatical system. He develops a calendar around both rest and remembrance and rejoicing in Yahweh God. And it's meant to take care of those that are dependent on the generosity and the love of others. And so every seventh day is to be a Sabbath day. Every seventh year is to be a sabbatical year. And every seven sets of 7 years is to be a year of Jubilee. And so he sets up this entire calendar of time for the Israelites to remember him, to not forget him, to take care and to love one another, and to always be reminding themselves of what he has called them to be and what his word says. These were designated times of rest, purposed by God to instill rest, reminders, remembrance, relief, restoration, and renewal, commitment to love and to serve him with all their heart. So the whole Israeli calendar was designed by Yahweh to constantly remind them of who he is, what he has done, what they are to be, and what he has sworn to do. And think about that. I mean, time itself was designed, and their calendar was designed so they could never forsake him or forget him. The only way they can forget him is by forsaking all of this, which sadly they did. But everything pointed to him. The new moon sacrifices pointed to him. The Sabbaths pointed to him. All of these things. And then in chapter 16, he gets into these appointed times of Yahweh. Within this whole sabbatical system, he actually sets apart seven appointed times that were designated by Yahweh God for the Israelites to remember these things. And not only that, but it reminds them. And this is what's crazy. These fixed times, or these appointed times of Yahweh God, point forward to the future work of Jesus Christ and what he will do, what he has done and what he will do when he returns. We hunkered down here for a little while, like 8 weeks, and talked about all the different significant scriptures of the appointed times of Yahweh in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, even Ezekiel and Zechariah for the millennial kingdom and the Feast of Booths. We talked about in Deuteronomy 16:16-17, he tells the Israelites three times a year, all the males shall appear before Yahweh your God in the place where he chooses. So this would be in Shiloh at the tabernacle until the temple is formed, and then in the temple in Jerusalem where his presence or where his name is at. They were to go up for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Booths. And they were to bring their offerings to the Lord and give as they are able, and according to the blessing that Yahweh has given them. And we talked about these different times of year. And you have your, basically, you can divide them into two different cycles. You have the spring cycle, which is Passover on Nisan 14. Right after that, the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Feast of First Fruits. And then the Feast of Weeks on at the end of the summer. And then the fall cycle, you have the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacles. All of those happen within a month period of time. And we talked about these implications. If you look in the New Testament, this is where it just got so neat. Because in the New Testament, Jesus Christ is called the Passover. I can't get into all this today. You got to go listen to the sermons. But basically, Jesus Christ is the Passover lamb, and the Passover is the point forward to the future sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And so we talked about the Passover, the New Testament. This is not us just trying to find types and figures. This is us taking New Testament scripture, which points back to who Christ is and what he has done. But the Passover is linked to the death of Christ. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is the sinless sacrifice of Christ. He says, he takes the Passover meal and takes the bread and says, this bread represents my body that will be broken for you. We talked about Hebrews 10, the Lord making a body for Jesus to come and to be the sacrifice for our sins. The Feast of First Fruits points to the resurrection of Christ. Again, you can see that in 1 Corinthians 15. And the Feast of Weeks points to the church. The Holy Spirit came on the day of Pentecost, which is the first day of the day of the Feast of Weeks. It was the first fruits of the Spirit, the first fruits of the new covenant, the beginning of the church. And so the spring cycle, these feasts were to remind Israel of who he is, what he has done for them, and how they are to worship him and the things they are to remember. But if they had obeyed, they never practiced these feasts throughout their history. In fact, there's scriptures that indicate that one of the first times they did practice the Feast of First Fruits and thing, or the Feast of Tabernacles, it was the first time that had happened since the day of Joshua. So immediately after they came to the land, they neglected all of this stuff, which is probably one of the reasons they missed the Messiah when he came, because they never, ever, ever submitted to the Lord, obeyed these things, and would have seen the implications of what Christ was meant to do in the spring cycle there. In the fall cycle, the Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacles, both in Ezekiel and Zechariah in the New Testament, we said we believe, again, because it hasn't happened yet, point to the rapture of the church and the ingathering of Israel, the repentance of Israel and the great tribulation on the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacles obviously will be done in the millennial reign of Christ. We see that in Ezekiel 45, and that's a feast that's to be performed when Christ returns and reigns as king in his glory here on earth. That was some cool stuff. That, like, if you haven't been here, I know that just was like, what in the world did you just talk about? Just go listen to each of those sermons. That was some really neat stuff that we dug out in Scripture. But just to get us back in tracking, and we're almost done here, here is where we kind of are. After we left the feasts and the appointed times, now we're into these judgments of the Lord. And the heart behind everything we've read so far is this righteousness that he desires. He desires in chapter 16 through 18, righteousness in his officials. And right now we're in the middle of number two there, righteousness in the civil law. So let me explain that and then we're caught up. But the first thing he says in chapter 16, at the very end of chapter 16, is he calls his leaders to lead the people in righteousness so that the people will live in righteousness. You have to have righteous officials and righteous priests and righteous kings that will come, righteous judges, living in submission and obedience to the Lord, both as an example of righteousness and to proclaim these things to the people so that they live in righteousness. Now you got to remember, they're going to come into the land, they're going to spread out through this land. And so these officials will be in different places, the heads of tribes and different judges and leaders. Levites spread out, and they must live in righteousness and lead in righteousness so the people around them know how to live in righteousness. That's what God is calling them to be. And so he reminds them, righteousness will be a protection for his people. If they forsake him and they do not submit to and listen to his law and his word, then that's going to be detrimental to them. That's going to bring about his judgment and his wrath. So the leaders must lead in righteousness so that the people live in righteousness, so they are protected by Yahweh God because they're living in righteousness. Righteousness was to be a provision for his people. Remember, the land promises and the blessings on the land are dependent upon them submitting to the Lord. So if they don't live in righteousness and faithfulness to him, then the crops aren't going to sprout. The rivers are going to drive up. There's going to be famine and things like that. And so righteousness is a provision. Do you see? Everything is focused on faithfulness to Yahweh. Their tangible, temporal blessing and what they need to live by is based upon their righteousness and faithfulness to him. And righteousness would be the purpose of his people. If they're not living in righteousness and faithfulness to him, then they're not living as a holy people. They can't be a kingdom of priests, and they're not going to be a light to the world. So he says, you must have righteous leadership in order for there to be righteous living. And then he talks about the different rulers. He says, righteous leaders, they will eliminate idolatry in chapter 17. Righteous leaders will seek and submit to Yahweh's word. So this is a call to the leaders of Israel. And righteous leaders will be selfless. They will be humble. They will be submissive to Yahweh. Their submission to the Lord, their humility that comes on their dependence of the Lord, and them obeying the Lord is what will cause the people that they are leading to both worship and follow Yahweh God. So there has to be righteous rulers. Then we talked about the religious rulers, the priests. Now you would think that the priests would live in righteousness. But again, historically you've seen that they were some of the first groups to forsake the Lord. And because of their forsaking the Lord, they caused all kinds of people to forsake the Lord in Israel. But he calls the righteous, the religious rulers to righteousness as well. He says the righteous priests will be dependent upon God. Righteous people do not imitate the world, and righteous prophets will proclaim God's word. He talks about the prophets that will come in the likeness of Moses. And I think that reverses all to Isaiah and Ezekiel and all the prophets that came after them that called them back to covenant faithfulness and obedience to the Lord. But most importantly, point to the one, Jesus Christ, who calls them to repentance and calls them to return to Yahweh with all of their heart. But no matter what, the prophets that will come will always call the Israelites back to submission and obedience to him. And then we get into the civil stuff, into the how to govern the nation. And that's where we left off. And we left off the last time we taught with Deuteronomy 19. And he basically, we called this righteousness in court. So when it comes to legal judgments, there still must be righteousness. There's a standard of righteousness that must happen within the law of Israel and how they conduct the nation. And so he talked about the cities of refuge. If there's an accidental killing, if you were, you know, swinging an axe and the head flew off and killed your brother, there was no harmful intent in your heart, it wasn't planned, it wasn't premeditated, anything like that, there's a place where the person committed the killed the other person can flee until there can be a trial and there can be a righteous judgment whether or not this was premeditated and there was evil in his heart or whether it was just an accident, and there was protection in these cities of refuge from anyone that wanted to enact revenge for the death of the other person. There was a permanency of boundaries. The land that was given to the tribes and within the tribes to the people, it was Yahweh's land and it was given to the Israelites. And so righteousness would be, there was a permanency of boundaries. You don't move the boundary stones and move property. You don't take the property of someone else. Or even if you inherit it for a while because they were poor, you give it back in the year of Jubilee. But the whole point was, this was Yahweh's land. It belonged to him. He gave it to his people. And his people shouldn't be greedy in taking parts of the land from other tribes or other people. And so there was a permanency of boundaries. But it was the court system or the civil law of Israel that made sure that these borders weren't moved and changed and things like that. And then finally, he talks about witnesses. There has to be integrity in witnesses that come to bring, in a trial, to bring testimony against someone. And so he talks about what to do with false witnesses and how there must be integrity in those who present a witness or a testimony in a trial. But again, the whole thing is there must be a standard of righteousness within the law, within the civil law of Israel. So all that being said, that's where we left off. We're talking about the righteousness of the officials, the righteousness of the leadership, the righteousness of the law in Israel. And next week, we're going to get into chapter 20, and we're going to talk about righteousness in warfare. They're going to go in and they're going to take the land. They're destroying everything in the land of Canaan. But once they're in the land of Canaan, they're still going to have nations around them. And at some point, these nations around them are either going to attack or the Lord's going to give them more territory. And he gives them standards of righteousness, even in warfare, on how a righteous and holy nation will engage in war in this sinful world and how that righteous standard is still to be upheld, even in the midst of warfare. So again, you can see the Lord taking care of his people. They are to be significant, distinct, and different than all the nations around. They are to be a holy nation. They are to be a kingdom of priests. But they are still existing as a nation. And there are still enemies that are going to be around them. They're still existing in a sinful world. And so this whole law is set up on how they are to love him with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength. How they are to love one another as themselves, how they are to love their neighbor, and even with the enemies around them. We're going to see more and more of how they are to conduct themselves so that even the nations around them see their law and their righteousness and know that their God is the one true God. Yahweh is the one true God that rules and reigns over everything. So all that being said, we'll pick up next week with righteousness and warfare. If all this sounds super boring, you can go to Richard's class. But if you're in, I think it's going to be great. And I cannot wait to get to the third exposition as well and look into the new covenant and stuff like that. So I just want to welcome like everyone that is new here to the class. It's so good seeing you here today. I know there's a lot of new things going on. But I hope that some of this was a blessing. I hope it catches you up. And like I said, if you come back next week, we'll be in Deuteronomy 20. Let me pray for us and we'll be dismissed.